Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you this week from Crested Butte, Colorado, in my new location. I'm your host, Mark Troutman. This educational personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. On this week's show, I want to address a listener's email. This one came in a few weeks ago, and this is what it said. Hey, Mark, I'm really enjoying Mark's Money Mind. You've inspired me to consider pursuing the CFP coursework, and that is Certified Financial Planner. My idea for an episode: talk through the concepts, curriculum, and materials, books, papers, etc., you use with the high school students you teach. I have two sons, one in his final year of high school, and one in his, hopefully, final year at CSU. That would be Colorado State University. Go Rams. Just down the road from you. I'm trying, perhaps a little late, to give them an education in and appreciation for thinking about finance and FI, that would be financial independence, goals. My starter reading list for the family is The Wealthy Barber, The Millionaire Next Door, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, The Simple Path to Wealth. Thank you for providing such great content in your podcast. Cheers, Will. It would be a very long podcast if I went through the entire curriculum and coursework that I teach at the high school. It's actually divided into 6 days. There are 7 modules. Instead of trying to go through the entire financial literacy class here on the podcast, I would direct you and anyone who is interested over to my blog, marksmoneymind.com. I will put the link in the show notes where you can see the entire class as it was presented in 2020. I recorded the class for COVID purposes. I could not go into the classroom, so I recorded videos. A number of people have asked about the program that I teach, so I just decided to put all the videos up there, free for anyone to view at any time. The handouts and everything are there. So feel free to go visit over there if you want to see the entire course. However, what I thought I could do on the podcast is give a brief overview of things I think are important to consider when teaching the next generation about these topics. I thought it would be a good conversation for a podcast episode. So here we go. I think it's really important to keep things as simple as possible, especially when you're explaining concepts such as the math behind financial independence, how you get there. In many cases, it can be information overload for the person who's receiving that information, particularly if it's a younger individual who may not want to really listen to their parents, for example. I like to boil it down into some very simple concepts. And the motto that my family has kind of lived by for decades now, really, is make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And when it comes to thinking about concepts surrounding becoming financially free, I think it can be boiled down to those 3 phrases. So let's talk about these components a little bit and just focus on keeping this whole process as simple as possible. So the first one, make some. All right. Seems fairly obvious. You need to have money in order to become financially independent. But what I'm talking about here, especially when it comes to younger generations, is encourage them to be industrious via some type of employment or even self-employment. For example, in my years past, I did things like I got paid to do some things around the house that my parents would have had to pay someone else to do. I remember my mom paying the cleaning lady, and I don't know that she was complaining about the job that the lady did or just the fact that maybe she didn't show up or something. I don't remember exactly the reason, but I thought to myself, I could do that. Would you pay me to do that? And she said, yeah, I would pay you to do that. And I do remember this one caveat that she reminds me of. I did say something to the effect of, but I don't clean toilets or something like that. But I did everything else. I vacuumed, I dusted, I mopped, I did everything I was supposed to do. And she paid me just as if she would have paid someone outside to do it and held me accountable for doing it on time and doing it right. And then I remember offering to paint some of the rooms in the house when my parents were thinking of hiring a painter to do it. I said, I could do that. Would you pay me to do that? And they were like, yeah, you need to do a good job. We're not going to pay you more than what it's worth. And we're going to hold you accountable. And I was like, sure, I'll do it. And it was the same with lawn work. They were paying someone to do their lawn. And I said, I would like to do that. And they said, absolutely, you can do it. And then realizing that the cleaning was fine and the painting was fine, but the lawn work was really kind of up my alley. So I said, you know what? I could probably do this for other people in the neighborhood. And I started my own little kind of lawn mowing business, I guess you would say, for a handful of people in the neighborhood. And I started making money that way. So I became industrious in a way that allowed me to earn some money and be able to spend it on the things that I chose to spend them on. I didn't need to go ask my parents, hey, can I have some money for this, that, or the other? I was making money, I was in charge of my own finances, and I could spend it how I pleased. Later, I went and did some caddying. I also worked at a car dealership at one point. So I had a lot of different jobs, and some of these were summer jobs in high school. Some of them were summer jobs in college. I always had a motivation to make money, and I was encouraged to do that. Now, I didn't really think a lot about saving at this point. I think it was more about having money to spend, and the saving and investing would come a little further down the road. So it really gave me some ability to be, I don't want to say independent, but more in control of my finances. I had to, especially when I had my little lawn business, I had to think about the cost, my hours, what to charge. So in a way, it was a way to learn business. So I think it's great if your kids want to certainly work at an employer somewhere, but also potentially start their own business, and maybe you can help them if it needs to be funded from the outset. Maybe you can make a deal with them, be an investor, require a return, and you can start teaching kind of the business skills as a result of them having their own small business. So I think that's very valuable. My daughter never started her own business, but she did go to work for some employers, and we live in a resort town, and she did realize how hard it is. Some of these jobs are pretty difficult, especially like in restaurants. And she realized that that's not what she wanted to do for the rest of her life. So it gave her some encouragement to do well in college so that she wouldn't have to resort to some of those jobs that required more manual labor, for example. And she chose to go to college and get a degree and do something more in the professional realm. So it can be advantageous for kids to have a job locally and find out maybe this type of job isn't for them. So that's the make some. Then we get to save and invest. And this is something that I wish I had learned earlier. It was something I learned much later, I would say. But this is something that we did instill in my daughter at a young age, and I encourage people to do that with their kids. And I think the key aspects are, of course, investing is probably a little bit further down the road, but saving is pretty simple to explain, especially to a younger individual. What you're trying to teach, in my opinion at least, is delayed gratification, that you need to save for things. And I do see some families, we used to live back east, and it was very common back east where families would literally buy their kids almost anything. You know, the kid would say, oh, I want a new iPhone. Oh, okay, we'll get you a new iPhone. Well, I don't think that's great from a learning perspective. I remember when my daughter wanted an iPhone, and this was a number of years ago, or in high school, I think it was, and we said, oh, that's great. You need to save up for that. And make a sizable contribution to that purchase. We did help out in a small way, but it required her to save and wait for that purchase and save up and make sure that that was something that she really wanted, because this was going to cost a lot of money. So I think the idea of not just buying everything for your kids is super important, because it teaches them that delayed gratification. Some parents will say, well, I'll lend you the money for you to buy that item. I think that's also disadvantageous as well, because what you're teaching them in that respect is borrowing money is okay. Now, there are times when borrowing money makes sense, but I do think that teaching or ingraining in them the concept of, oh, if I want something, I will just borrow for it, is not necessarily the best approach. So even if you're lending them money at a zero interest rate, I still think it's opening them up for the idea that, well, if I want something, I just borrow for it. And I think that would be better to save for it and then decide whether it really is important. And many times I remember I would save for something, and by the time I got the money, I didn't really want it as much anymore, or I didn't want it to the degree that I would have to part with the funds to buy it. So I think that's also healthy as well. And you could help them open a savings account, for example. I like online savings banks. They pay a decent amount of interest. They're very easy to open. You can, in many cases, create savings buckets within a savings account. I know Ally Bank, for example, allows you to do that. I have no affiliation with Ally in any way, but I do use them for savings accounts and their bucketing approach. And I'm sure other banks offer the same thing, but that's a way to kind of segment your savings into different savings buckets. And then we get to investing. So the second part of the save and invest. And this is where it gets a little bit more, I don't want to say complicated, but it's a little further down the road. It may be if the child is in high school, they can certainly grasp this concept. You could help them open an investment account. We actually opened an investment account for our daughter before she was even aware of it, and then later brought her into the conversation about it when I think she was, I don't know, maybe 12 or something like that. But we had opened the account when she was born. But we started having discussions once she was of a reasonable age, 10, 12, what have you. You could help them open an investment account if they're under, I think it's 18 in most cases. It might have to be a custodial account where you're the custodian for the account, but there are social security numbers on the account. So it could be just a regular brokerage account. It could be a Roth IRA. If they have earned income, if they have a job, they can open a Roth IRA to the extent that they have earnings to fund it, and they don't even have to be the ones to fund it. You could fund it, or you could match. That might be a great idea. Consider a matching program where if they put X dollars in their savings account or investment account, you match it to some degree, and you're teaching them the value of the matching concept, which they will likely be exposed to once they start working and have a 401k, for example, with a matching component. And then talking about the idea of compounding. I won't get into the details here. It is my favorite subject to talk about in the financial literacy class. You can go to the blog post and see that module on compounding. I try to break it down to make it easily understandable. Basically, I ask my students, do you want to become a millionaire? And of course, they all raise their hands and I show them how simple it is. I actually did a podcast episode on compounding. I don't recall the number offhand, but I will put that in the show notes. My example was learned from my grandmother. She, and I think I might have talked about this in the compounding episode, so pardon me for repeating the story, but it was very, very eye-opening to me. She purchased 9 shares of Coca-Cola when her husband passed away, and she received a very small life insurance policy. I think those shares cost her around $1,000 at the time. She never sold the shares, but she did receive the dividends over her lifetime. And because of stock splits and so forth, it was, I think, 3,000 shares at the time she died. It was crazy how large that investment grew from just those original 9 shares. And it was certainly a lesson for me in compounding. And that was something that really took hold for me and made me want to invest and learn more about this. The other thing we've done on the save and invest side for my daughter and ourselves as well is we kind of instituted what I like to call the rule of 20%. And that is we have always saved 20% of everything we earned. And let me back up. I can't say always. We always did it once we learned about it. And I think it really hit home when we read the book, The Wealthy Barber, which Will referenced in his email. And it talked about saving, I think in the book, it was 10%. And I think The Millionaire Next Door, they talked about many millionaires save 20%. And once we read those two books, we were just like, okay, we're just going to do that. We're always going to save 20% of everything we make. And that was something that we passed down to my daughter. And she did the same thing ever since she earned a dime, even from like allowance or from a gift from a relative, she would save 20%. And I think it's really good to get younger folks or older folks as well started on getting used to saving a percentage of your income for later use, whether it's retirement for the normal age people like me or for something down the road. Maybe it's a down payment on a house. Maybe it's saving for a down payment or the entire purchase of a vehicle, for example. And I really like the idea of setting a rule and just saying, okay, we're going to keep it simple. We're just going to always save X percentage of whatever we make. I like the number 20%. I think it's a good starting point. People in the FIRE community, which is financial independence, retire early, would probably argue somewhere north of 50%. It's up to you to decide what you want to do, but I would say 20% is a good starting point. And then the other thing is once you start working or your child starts working or you start working, whoever's listening to this starts working, enroll in the company's 401k plan if it's offered. And in many 401k plans, there's going to be a default contribution amount. And in many cases, it's fairly small. I want to say it's in the neighborhood of 3-6% is what they may start you out at. And that's even if they auto enroll you. Many companies do auto enroll you today, but not always. So I would suggest setting a target higher than that. And when young people come to me and ask me, what percentage should I save in my 401k plan? I usually suggest a minimum of 10%. For some people, that's a tough pill to swallow. 10% might be a lot. But for somebody new who's just starting out, saving 10% of an amount of income that they haven't been used to yet should be pretty simple, should be pretty easy to digest. So I really like to tell people, set it at least 10%. Most companies will allow you to auto-escalate it, meaning that every year they might raise it by 1% or 2 percentage points. Let that auto escalation stay in place. Maybe don't even turn it off until you max out your 401k contributions every year. And then in many cases, you'll be getting a match as well. So maybe you'll get 3% match or a 4% match, and that's on top of your 10 plus percent with the auto escalation. And this brings to mind an article I just read. It was in the Wall Street Journal on October 7th. So just a few days ago. And it was kind of eye-opening to me. I never really thought about this. The title was Changing Jobs Can Put a $300,000 Dent in Retirement Savings. And I'm, of course, you know, clickbait title, right? And you're like, what are they talking about? Well, it's a very real situation. People leave jobs and get a new job. And in many cases, they are then auto-enrolled in their new 401k plan. And they're auto-enrolled at that initial target amount, which may be 3-6%, for example. And then maybe they have the auto-escalation. But if they change jobs every few years, they're constantly going from maybe they got up to 10% at their prior employer, but then they get in, go to a new employer and they're reset back down to 3-6%. And instead of going over to the new employer and saying, hey, you know what, my last job, I was up to contributing as much as, let's say, hypothetically 14%. I want to keep that in place. So at my new job, employer, please set my savings or 401k contribution target to that same 14%. And if you get a raise, maybe even go ahead and bump it up more than that. And it was a very interesting article. I will put a link to it in the show notes. I won't go through the whole thing, but the quote at the beginning of the article was, "The majority of people who change jobs wind up putting less of their pay into their 401ks, often without realizing it, according to new research from Vanguard Group. That is because many job switchers either forget to sign up for the 401k plan or get auto-enrolled at a lower savings rate." And then they do the math on how much that could affect you, and that's where that $300,000 figure came from. So something to keep in mind, you know, I worked at my job for, I was at the same employer for over 20 years. And one piece of advice I received from the person who hired me at that job that I stayed at for those two decades, as soon as I was hired, he said, "You're getting a raise by coming over here. I suggest you max out your 401k contribution." And he also said, "And put it in equities. From this point forward, you won't notice a difference in your net paycheck because of the raise you're getting." And at the time, I look back, it was actually approximately 10% of what I was being paid. So it was right around that 10% figure. And over time, because the limits were raised and I personally increased my percentages as I could, I effectively maxed out my 401k since I was 20, I want to say that was 23 years old, and I retired when I was 50. So for 27 years, I maxed out my 401k, and that allowed me to retire early. So just that one simple thing, kind of like that rule of 20%, if all I did was that, everything kind of worked out. So a lot of this can boil down to some very simple, basic concepts. And then the third piece of the motto, make some, save and invest, is live on the rest. And I think it's important to talk about this because I do believe that prioritizing savings and investing, paying yourself first, is a critical path to achieving financial independence or financial freedom. But it's also important to live for today. And that's the constant balance, I think, that we're all trying to work with here, is how do we save for the future but enjoy today? So it's not all about deprivation and saving it all for the future. I know many in the FIRE community talk about saving very high percentages of their income for a short period of time to get to this point where they're financially independent. I am not 100% on board with that. I think it can be done in a kind of a slower fashion. And I think I talked about this in another episode, the slower approach to reaching financial independence, still reaching it, but maybe not trying to reach it as fast as possible. So living on the rest, and that would be maybe 80% of your net income, of course, after taxes, right? Because you need to enjoy today as well. It's important to enjoy the fruits of your labor. Now, I was enjoying when I first started working in my lawn mowing and caddying days, I was enjoying 100% and not saving anything really. But I probably would have been just as happy if I was saving 20% and living on the balance. I still would have enjoyed everything to the same degree. Now, the important thing I think is learning something that I think Ramit Sethi refers to as conscious spending. So in other words, you only have a finite amount of money to spend, let's say this 80% of whatever you're making, and you need to think about how you're spending it with your eyes wide open, I guess you would say. So in other words, really consciously think about how you're spending your money. Is it in line with what's important to you? And for every dollar you spend, that means it's a dollar that can't be spent on something else. So thinking about every purchase, and it may not be every single purchase, but a majority of your purchases, I think it's very important. It's so easy today to just click buy on Amazon and it'll show up tomorrow. But I like the idea of creating a wish list instead of just instantaneously buying things. maybe avoiding temptation by not going to the mall every Friday afternoon. I don't even know if people do that anymore. I don't have malls around me, so I wouldn't know. But if you go to an area where you can easily spend money, maybe avoid doing that. And then just really thinking about what is important to you, and is your spending aligned with what is important to you? And then let time pass before making really big money decisions. Maybe write it down, say, hey, I really would like to get this, but I'm going to put it on this list. I'm going to revisit it in a week. And in many cases, you may find that you really don't really want it as much as you originally thought. And then getting back to the parents here a little bit, because that's the crux of the email, I think it's very important to model the behavior yourself and include your children or next generation or whoever you're mentoring or teaching in conversations about finances. Open up about your finances to them. And I think what you'll find is, and my daughter has confirmed this, what you do and what they observe will have a much larger impact than any preaching you can do about what they should do. So they are going to be paying very close attention to how you live your life and run your finances, and that will probably have a bigger impact. And I also think it's important to include them on family conversations about finances. We've included our daughter in many of our family financial decisions so that she can see the logic behind why we made the choices that we did. In fact, when I sold my house just recently, now she's older, she's in her mid-20s now, but I included her in that whole decision-making process to talk about what does it mean, why am I doing it, instead of just, oh, dad's selling his house and I can't go there anymore. It was more about, oh, look at why I'm doing this. What are the ramifications of not having this house anymore, the finances around it, and so forth. And we've done that before. When we moved to Colorado originally, we talked about it. When we originally rented a house instead of immediately buying a house, why we were doing it. When we went to purchase a house, why we purchased the house that we did, how much it cost, how we were even financing it, we talked about. So include them in these conversations as much as you're comfortable, but I think you will find if you're willing to include them, A, they're going to be appreciative of how much you respect them, but also it does give them an insight into how finances work within a family, and it will, I think, benefit them in the long run. And so some of the books that you recommended, I agree with: The Wealthy Barber, The Millionaire Next Door, Simple Path to Wealth for sure. Not a huge fan of Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Some people are, some people aren't. It's not necessarily my favorite book. But the one book that I also recommend is a book by Ramit Sethi called I Will Teach You to Be Rich. I think it's a very sensational title, but it is a very good read and a very good kind of blueprint on how to design your financial life, I guess you would say, so that you can reach those goals. So that is one book that is at the top of my list. I think it's well written. I think it's easily digestible by younger individuals, for example, high school, college age students. The Simple Path to Wealth, I think, is a great complement to that book as well. So those two are the two I would recommend. I would consider reading them together, maybe not sitting down next to each other and actually reading them at the same time, but each reading a chapter and then having a conversation about what did that chapter mean? Did you understand everything? Is there anything you want to talk about in it? Is there anything we can implement that chapter recommended? Because I Will Teach Me Rich is really a step-by-step process on how to set up checking accounts, savings accounts, credit cards, and so forth, investment accounts. Same with Simple Path to Wealth, many to-do items in that book. So work through the books together as a team, and I think you'll find that approach will be super beneficial. Now, if there are parents that are listening or just individuals that are listening that want to think about how do I do this for younger children, there's a book called Raising Your Money Savvy Family for Next Generational Financial Independence, a very long title, excellent book, by Carol Pittner and Doug Nordman. And it's a extremely good book for teaching the younger generations money savvy or money scripts, I guess you would say, to the extent that it starts off with very young children and how to talk about money with extremely young children. And Carol is Doug's daughter. So this is a father-daughter team that wrote this book. And of course, like I said, feel free to jump over to my blog. You can see the entire financial literacy course over there. So I hope this was kind of a keep it simple approach to what I think is most important about passing along this knowledge to the next generation. It really boils down to just a few things, and then just keeping at it, figuring out how to make money, saving and investing a percentage of it, paying yourself first, and living on the difference, and really trying to avoid the big mistakes. And those would be things like excessive borrowing, borrowing money on credit cards at crazy interest rates, buying things that you don't really need, signing yourself up for costs that continue. For example, if you own a second home, it's not just the initial purchase, it's the continuous cost of that. It's just an example. I'm sorry for anyone who owns a second home. It is an indulgence, and it sometimes costs more than you think because it's beyond just the initial purchase cost. That can be the same for cars. It can be the same for all kinds of things, boats, whatever, RVs, you name it. So I have nothing against second homes, but it's just an example. Anyway, I hope this was helpful. I think I like to distill everything down to that simple motto of make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And with that, I'll leave it and see you next time. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name, or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous, and also your state of residence if you choose. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next week on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.